And it's for this reason that Ficino often recommends bright colored foods, things like saffron, golden-hued wines, or even gold itself, because they have a certain sympathetic affinity with the sun, which is the power of light, knowledge, clarity, understanding. So harnessing these occult forces of the sun is done by eating or drinking gold, and that actually makes you smarter.
Welcome back to Food, a Cultural Culinary History, a podcast brought to you by The Great Courses Plus. I'm Jason Smigel, and like you, I'm a lifelong learner. I've been listening to The Great Courses for over 14 years, and I'm excited to be sharing this great course as a podcast with you. This podcast is hosted by Ken Albala, who's professor of history and chair of food studies at the University of the Pacific. He's also the author of Ken Albala's Food Rant, a highly popular blog for people who love food. Episode 15, A Renaissance in the Kitchen. The Italian Renaissance brought a new aesthetic approach to cookery, featuring great complexity of presentation. In this podcast, we're going to uncover some of the era's extremes in books by Renaissance food writers. We'll study menus and recipes from the staggeringly elaborate banquets of the court of Ferrara. As always, if you're interested in trying any of Ken's recipes and food experiments, or even seeing photos and illustrations of the concepts that Ken mentions in this podcast, you can find supporting materials for this podcast at thegreatcoursesdaily.com.
The period we will cover now extends roughly from the 15th to early 16th century and is commonly referred to as the Renaissance. For the history of food, the Renaissance overlaps the late Middle Ages and really extends into the early modern period. In other words, it's a transitional period that crosses over what I think is really the important dividing line of about 1500. And cuisine all the way until 1500 essentially remains medieval. After that, it's early modern. So there's not really a Renaissance style of cooking in between. So what we'll cover is this transition that takes place from about 1400 to 1550. But I'll leave all the momentous events in the New World following 1492 for another lecture. The setting for the Renaissance is the wealthy cities of late medieval Italy. They were actually city-states because they governed the surrounding contado or countryside, running their own affairs, getting extraordinarily rich by supplying the rest of Europe with luxury items and spices like Venice, or credit as did Florence, or with a monopoly on spiritual matters as did Rome, with the center of Western Christendom. And I should throw in also Milan, which was also a very wealthy, powerful city in the north of Italy, along most of the major crossroads from north to south and east to west. And there are also a handful of smaller cities that become very important in the Renaissance. They're courts, and they become models of taste and culture, cities like Ferrara and Mantua and Urbino. The Renaissance itself, of course, means rebirth. But rebirth of what? First and foremost, this is an intellectual movement that sought to revive the culture of classical antiquity by imitating its arts and literature, by building structures that looked like ancient Greek and Roman buildings, and by depicting naked bodies in marbles, just like the ancient. And it even extends into government. You know, politicians read ancient histories and political tracts and used them didactically to govern their own states. And what they sought was to equal, if not even surpass, the greatness of ancient Greece and Rome. This imitation was made possible partly through archaeology, and I mean literally digging up old statues, restoring ruined buildings, but more important, it was recovering ancient texts. And remember how Europe received Greek and Roman works on science and agriculture, whatever, via these translations that were made from Arabic into Latin? Well, these tended to be corrupt or garbled or usually incomplete. And now, scholars hunted down good copies in the original languages, and most importantly, is they learned to read ancient Greek, especially after Constantinople fell to the Turks in 1453, and this whole troop of Greek scholars escaped to the West, often with their books. So they taught a whole generation how to read Greek, and we're talking here about reading Plato for the first time in the original, Euclid, Galen, Vitruvius, etc. They also went into old monasteries and long discarded libraries, and they began to find and read classical texts copied out hundreds of years before. And in fact, a perfect example of this is that text of the Roman cookbook attributed to Apicius. Remember, it was written about 400 or so in ancient Rome, and then it was copied in Fulda in the 800s during the reign of Charlemagne. And then basically it was forgotten until about the 1400s when a Renaissance scholar, this guy Bartolomeo Sacchi, usually known as Platina, finds it and then writes about it, and eventually it's published. Which of course brings us to what is probably the single most important invention of this entire story, is the printing press. Think about this. No longer does a text, and I mean a cookbook, whatever, have to be copied by hand, and it's not anymore something only the wealthiest of people could afford to have done. It can now be printed out by the hundreds, even in a cheap format. And it almost immediately stimulates a rise in literacy, as well as this vast literature of, let's just call them how-to books. The overall effect of the printing press is that it speeds the pace of change. Information can reach people more quickly, knowledge can be standardized and codified, and not only was all this classical literature printed, but new books on almost every imaginable topic, and as we'll see in a moment, things like cooking and diet and agriculture and herbals and books on manners. I mean, dozens of different food-related topics. And it was, in fact, a major communications revolution. I mean, the only ones I can compare it to are either the invention of writing itself or the invention of the computer, which we're in the middle of right now. So another term will explain why writers shifted their attention from topics that preoccupied medieval writers to more, let's say, practical concerns, things like cooking and diet. The classical revival movement is also often called humanism. Now don't confuse this term with the modern connotation of secular humanism, especially because these tended actually to be very religious people. What it means here is a focus on practical human affairs, topics they believed would improve the human condition. So things like ethics rather than abstract theology, topics like rhetoric or public speaking rather than logic, or studying poetry and art rather than canon law. In other words, this was really a major shift in the curriculum, which sought to make people more, let's say, well-rounded citizens rather than just professionals trained as theologians or lawyers. And it is training in the topics that we now refer to as the humanities. And the idea is that learning across a variety of disciplines will make you a better and more rounded person. And then the focus, of course, is on the humans rather than heavens and the afterlife. And that meant that everyday topics like maintaining a household, cooking a healthy meal, how to throw a banquet, those become really serious topics worthy of study. So let's begin with the very first printed cookbook. It's called De Honesta Voluptate, which means sort of on honest pleasure, written by this very same Bartolomeo Sacchi, Platina, which appeared around 1470 in Rome. At least the first dated edition is 1474, but there's an earlier one. First of all, it is actually two books that sit, I think, rather uncomfortably together. The recipes are borrowed from this man, Martino of Como, who is a professional chef for Cardinal Trevisan. And he wrote a cookbook that, it actually circulated in manuscript in the early 15th century. So it's not really his, but most of the recipes, he compiles them, they're associated with him. And Platina, of all strange things, translated these Italian recipes into Latin. That's unusual. Normally they're just in the vernacular. And he stuffed them into his own book, which is really mostly about natural history, you know, where plants and animals originate, how they grow, I guess what we would call today biology, and then a whole healthy dose of dietary medicine. And as I said, the two parts don't really fit well together because there'll be a recipe for something on one page and then on another, Platina will be telling you that it's really bad for your health and don't eat it. After an eggplant recipe, he says, feed this one to your enemies. But presumably, as the title suggests, he was offering a way for readers to enjoy themselves at the table and observe some dietary rules and stay healthy. Platina is thus recommending the classical ideal of moderation, balance of pleasure and health. And that's a very different eating aesthetic than the fast and feast mentality, right? He's saying pleasure is fine, but not gross indulgence. Dietary rules are fine, but not asceticism and self-mortification. And he offers these guidelines on how to strike a balance and sort of maintain it year-round. So what's in this fascinating book? First, there's Martino, and Martino is really a late medieval cookbook. I mean, it still has the same sugar and spices and sweet and sour sauces and peacock's flame, you know, spewing flames. But Martino was actually innovative in several ways. He offers apparently the very first recorded instance of egg whites being used to clarify a broth. He also offers instructions for making an edible short crust pastry. Before then, pastry shells were usually just meant to keep the contents of a pie intact and moist, but they weren't really eaten. They're just usually flour, often rye flour and water. There's also a tendency to present individual ingredients whole rather than pounded up and disguised as, we know, medieval cooks were so fond of doing. But probably the most important is this heavy emphasis on vegetables. I mean, he treats them as dishes in their own right and offers all sorts of interesting recipes for things like asparagus and artichokes. And they're boiled and seasoned very simply with salt, oil, maybe a little vinegar. You might also be interested to know that he has several recipes for cooking with marijuana, of all things. I mean, there's one in which the seeds are ground up and cooked with salt and pepper, and then they're laid on slices of toast and sprinkled with sugar and spices and stacked. And I think by the end of the thing, Platina comes in at the end and says, this is very bad for you. It dulls your eyesight. But I guess it does actually satisfy the munchies before they set in, right? So anyway, and then there's the part by Platina. For his entries, he will typically quote Pliny or a Roman agricultural writer. There may be a bit on how these things were valued in ancient times. And remember, this is primarily a piece of humanist scholarship. And then he'll tell you its medical properties, how easily it's digested or not, and what kind of humors it may provoke. Let me give you an example. This is on sugar, okay? It says sugar comes not only from Arabia, which is wrong, and India, but also from Crete and Sicily, which is actually where they just started planting them. Pliny calls it honey collected from a cane. It's really fine when it's ground up or even crunched by the teeth. And surely the whiter, the better, which it becomes through a long purification. It is hot and moist and thus nutritious, good for the stomach. It soothes stomach aches if there are any. However, in cholerics, it is easily converted into the dominant humor. He continues, I think the ancients used sugar merely for medicinal purposes. And he's right about that. And for that reason, no mention is made of it among their foods. But they were surely missing a great pleasure, for nothing given us to eat is so insipid that sugar does not make it better. In other words, sugar goes on everything, okay? And it does. And here's the best part. He says, no kind of food is made more tasteless by adding sugar. By melting it, we make almonds softened and cleaned in water, pine nuts, hazelnuts, coriander, anise, and cinnamon into many other things. Sweets he's talking about, and this is a really candy-oriented culture. It's in his entry for milk that he explains that it is somewhat cold and humid, but still nourishing, and some kinds of milk are better than others. He says goat's milk is better than sheep's, and the worst for drinking is fresh cow's milk. But here's the odd part. He says the absolute best is fresh human milk, especially from a healthy young woman of a beautiful, moderate complexion. So, let's move from Rome to Florence, which is really the birthplace of humanism, many would argue. And let's focus on one particular thinker who represents the late phase of Renaissance humanism. He's about the same age as Platina, a little younger, but their two books could not possibly be more different. This is Marsilio Ficino, a scholar specializing in Plato, who was supported by the ruler of Florence, who's Lorenzo de' Medici. And according to an account written by Ficino, he and a group of friends gathered together at the Medici Villa at Careggi on the birthday of Plato. It's a fictional account, but still. And they decided to have a symposium in his honor. And supposedly, on this day, they founded the Platonic Academy, which really did become a kind of research institute later. There were 9 men there that day, the same number as the Muses. and they discuss Plato, and in fact, they're the first generation, remember, that can read it in Greek. So, unfortunately, we don't know what they ate that evening, but we do know a great deal about Ficino's ideas about food, because his father was actually a physician, and he ended up writing this book called De Vita, which means on life, or De Vita Triplici, the three parts of life. And it's mostly a diet book about things scholars should eat to help them stay healthy, to maintain clear, rational thoughts, and live, as Ficino says, in harmony with the stars. Now, this is going to sound a little strange to you, but Ficino believed that beyond what humans know of the physical world and what they're taught by Christianity, there are also unseen or occult forces in the universe. And occult doesn't have sort of demonic associations then at all. But he says, and there are also ancient books that teach people how to harness these forces or how to perform magic. And Ficino comes to the conclusion that all these ancient traditions essentially taught the same truths that are revealed in Christianity. He was what we would call a syncretist. So Plato and Moses and Hermes Trismegistus, they're all talking about the same God. And white magic and astrology are not inconsistent with the teachings of the church at all. And this was also in his approach to food, in the book De Vita. It's on the one hand based on standard Galenic principles. You know, he talks about hot and cold food, humoral balances. But it also has this admixture of astrology and magic, what foods you can eat to harness these unseen forces of the universe, and how to avoid what he considered the most dangerous disease of scholars, which was melancholy. Now, the idea that underlies much of his thought is called the doctrine of signatures, which basically means that the power of a given substance will be revealed by its outward form, its shape, or its color. For example, walnuts are good for the brain because they look like one. A red plant will be good for the blood. And God sort of leaves these little signs as a hint to food's therapeutic value, what it's good for in us. We just have to really look closely. And it's for this reason that Ficino often recommends bright colored foods, things like saffron, golden-hued wines, or even gold itself, because they have a certain sympathetic affinity with the sun, which is the power of light, knowledge, clarity, understanding. So harnessing these occult forces of the sun is done by eating or drinking gold, and that actually makes you smarter. And for the same reason, he forbids dark foods, because they'll promote melancholy and they're linked to Saturn, which is the melancholy planet.
If you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts, the new audio and video streaming site from The Great Courses, the leader in lifelong learning. Featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from building your vocabulary, paganism, brain fitness, computer programming, cooking healthy food, and a whole lot more. At The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.
So this is a recipe for revitalizing foods, meant to fortify what's called the radical moisture of the body. Remember that lamp metaphor from Hippocrates? That's what he's talking about. And it's basically a little gilded meat patty made from chicken entrails. Let me just read it quickly. You will easily maintain the moisture in the entire tree of the body if you preserve it in the roots. Therefore, take the heart, liver, stomach, testicles, and brains of hens, cook them in water with a pinch of salt, grind them up with broth and sugar, add a fresh egg yolk, and make a little cake seasoned with cinnamon and saffron, and coat it with gold. Okay, so each of these things is supposed to give your body strength because they're nutritious and easily digested, but it's a food that harnesses the sun's power. Ficino also, I should say, totally outdoes Platina on the topic of breast milk. He says, for old people who need reviving, choose a young girl who is healthy, beautiful, cheerful, and temperate, and when you are hungry and the moon is waxing, suck her milk. Immediately eat a little powder of sweet fennel properly mixed with sugar. But if you can't find an attractive lactating girl, he says, why shouldn't our old people, namely those who have no other recourse, likewise suck the blood of a youth? A youth, I say, who is willing, healthy, happy, and temperate, whose blood is of the best, but perhaps too abundant. And he suggests an ounce or two from a freshly opened vein on the left arm, followed by sugar and wine, but only when the moon is waxing. Isn't that lovely? Bizarre. So these therapies were a quirk of Renaissance medicine. They're not a revival from ancient Greece or Rome. And interestingly, they seem to disappear by the 18th century. We can guess why. Apart from these bizarre recipes, there's also a great deal of what we would now call aromatherapy, burning scented woods, incense, smelling certain herbs, as well as all sorts of advice on sleeping and sex, when to work and rest. It's a very interesting book, and I wouldn't say it's mainstream in dietary thought, but it's kind of out in left field in many respects. But Florentines, surprisingly, they're still eating much the same medieval diet. One other thing is, you know, Ficino was a very influential thinker. If you might know the painting of Primavera by Botticelli and The Birth of Venus, those are directly inspired by Ficino's Platonic theories of love. So, something else changes as we cross into the 16th century. There are major demographic and economic changes. I'll get to those next time. But there's also a new aesthetic approach to food, and I believe it mirrors changes that are happening in the arts. The change is meant to reinvent taste, so most people don't actually get it. It happens in all the arts because, on the one hand, aristocratic feasts, you know, I mean, there were always multimedia events. There was always music and food and sculptures and various other forms of entertainment like plays and dances. And in fact, the leading artists are usually commandeered to design these banquets. So the innovations in the art were, I think, bound to affect the food and what was being served, and then, in fact, the way it was served. The other is that a people's taste in art and entertainment, I think, has to be reflected in the food that they want. You know, is it refined and elegant? Is it homey and comforting, rustic and outdoorsy? You know, the person, I think, who likes opera, for example, will want rare European wines to match it. And the guy who is watching the football, you know, prefers chili and a bag of Doritos and a beer, right? So what I'm saying is that the same aesthetic that governs choice in entertainment usually governs the choice of food also. Now, with that in mind, let's turn to Ferrara, to the court of Duke Ercole d'Este, and a cookbook written describing the banquets that are thrown there. It is called Banchetti, meaning banquets, by this guy Cristoforo di Messisbugo. And I would say Messisbugo's banquets are a perfect match for the style of art flourishing at the time, which is known as Mannerism. And it can be described as a self-consciously elaborate and very sophisticated style that sought to venture beyond the very balanced, rational compositions of the Renaissance, because it depicts figures in sort of twisted positions, sometimes placed into illogical settings. Human anatomy is ignored. And by using odd juxtapositions, surprising and densely packed surfaces, even a staggering variety of forms, Mannerist artists are really trying to display their wit and inventiveness. They want to titillate the viewer with marvels and obscure allegories, not only that display the knowledge of the artist, but in a sense, they flatter the spectator who gets it, you know? So for the Mannerist, artificiality and the depiction of the impossible, contrived and deliciously perverse subjects, that's a positive virtue. Artificial's a good word. And this style influenced the cutlery especially. I mean, you look at table settings and presentation, the food, it's undeniable. It is also arguably affecting how and what foods were served and how they were prepared. So although the basic outlines of Italian cuisine at the start of the 16th century, they're essentially inherited from the Middle Ages, there's, you know, the spices don't disappear yet. There's sugar and sauces based on vinegar. But something else begins to change noticeably. In Messisbugo's description of banquets that he threw, it reveals that a diversity of dishes, bordering on what I would call perversity, spectacles and surprises and all these ingenious novelties all show, I think, that Mannerist aesthetics are at play. Grand presentation pieces have become a feature of courtly dining for centuries, right? But there's something different about the sheer profusion of delicacies that appear in every course. A typical banquet, sometimes with as many as a dozen separate courses, would include salads, soups, vegetables, pastries, pies, and sweet in every single course. And especially these little allegorical scenes made of sugar. as well as fish and meats in nearly every single course. And rather than present an orderly procession of dishes, as we would, you know, go from soup to nuts, the diner is meant to be overwhelmed by the variety and the elegance of each successive presentation. Many foods, for example, appear in every single course, although they're presented in a slightly different way, and only the barest hints of order are discernible. You know, there's generally colder foods to start, and there's fruits and sweets to conclude, but otherwise, no order as we would recognize it. But let me give you a concrete example, okay? This is a banquet thrown January 23rd, 1529, by the son of the Duke of the Ferrara for his father and various dignitaries that were invited. And the guest list is only 104 people. Sugar sculptures of the labors of Hercules appear first, and these are in deference to the host, whose name is Ercole. The antipasto course consisted of cold dishes. This is a caper, truffle, and raisin salad in a pastry, an endive and radicchio salad with citron juice, and anchovy salads. There were also radishes carved into shapes and animals, little cream pies, prosciutto of pork tongue, boar pies, mortadella and liver pies, smoked mullet served several different ways, and then gilthead bream. And then there follow 9 separate main courses. The first hot course has capon fritters sprinkled with sugar, quails, tomasella, which is a liver sausage, capon liver stuffed into a caul, that's a netting of pork fat, and roasted, then pheasants, then a carabaccia of onions, then pigeons in puff pastry, then tarts of fish milt, that's a spleen, then fried trout tails and barbel, kind of fish, eel pie, pike served in broth. That's just the first course, folks. And the second course had franklins, a kind of bird, quails, meatballs, cervelat sausage, veal, capon, a German style in a sweet white wine sauce with mace, pigeon pastries, carp, turbo, shrimp, trout roe, a yellow almond concoction, then other pastries. Then it's a play or something to break it up. Then a third course comes out. Partridge, rabbit, turtle dove, sausage, capon, pigeons, more fish. That goes on to a fourth. And then again with birds, fish, rice pie, other dishes. And then a fifth course, a suckling pig, veal, more birds, fish. A sixth course, and more, another veal, prepared a different way. Peacock, goat, boar, and then more fish, and then a seventh course. I know, this is going on and on, but that's the whole point of it. By the end of the whole thing, by the eighth course, 2,000 oysters and oranges and other pastries come out. The ninth course, citron, lettuce, cucumbers, almond and syrup, fruits and various pastries. There was also a play, in fact, by Ludovico Ariosto to start, and these lovely musical interludes between each course. But what is amazing to me is that guests were given individual plates for many of these dishes. Only the larger foods or presentations of several ingredients together came out either in multiples of 25 or 50. And those would have, of course, been divided and served. But many of the foods came out in multiples of 104 on 25 larger plates as well, because Mrs. Bugo actually specifies the number of plates you need for this banquet. And I thought, let me just count them, see what's going on here. There are 2,835 plates used. And the recipes themselves are no less staggering for their variety and profusion. There's a recipe for sozzomelli, a kind of cookie that includes cinnamon and pepper and rose water and musk that's added to white flour, eggs, and sugar. And that's one of the simpler ones. But I think it gives you a good idea of the flavors appreciated by the Ferrarese court, which like these contrasting sweet, spicy, aromatic flavors. Here's another one, and this is particularly interesting, not only because of the bizarre method of making this thing that's called a pizza. It bears no relationship to what we think of now, but these are puffs, and they're more commonly like sort of tidbits placed on the credenza before the guests arrive, and so they're a starter. But presumably, his audience knows what these are supposed to look like, because he says, make your pizzas, and I think, interestingly, this is where butter appears, and it starts to take a major role in the cuisine. So let me read this. It's to make 10 puff pastry pizzas, pull the soft interior out of 4 white breads and soak in tepid water, take 3 pounds of the finest wheat flour, 10 egg yolks, and 1 pound of fresh butter, 3 ounces of rose water, 7 ounces of sugar. Mix everything together with the bread, making a dough. Roll it out into a sheet as you would lasagna dough and make it as light as you can, and then take a pound and a half of fresh butter, heated, pour it over the sheet, let it cool, then roll a spiral pastry cutter through the length of the sheet and cut it into 10 pieces and make your puff pizzas. Have a pan ready with 4 pounds of fresh butter and fry your puff pizzas in it, and they presumably puff up. And when they're fried, sprinkle sugar over them. So some of Mrs. Bugo's recipes contain crushed coral or pearls, and those are supposed to be restorative, but they're impressive because of the cost, really. The sugar, the spices, the rose water that flavor so many of these dishes are also just as luxurious. And I should mention also a whole slew of foreign dishes from Germany, Spanish, Turkish, French, Hungarian. There's a Hebraic dish, in fact, that's made of veal and herbs and raisins and spices that's sort of formed around a hardened egg yolk, and it's cooked in a broth. So I don't want to say that the recipes are all completely outlandish. That one's actually really nice and tasty too. But I don't want to leave Mrs. Bugo without sampling one of his more extravagant, let's call it a perversity. Okay, it's lovely though. It's a Lenten eel pie. Now imagine this. It begins with spinach fried in a pan with oil, followed by almonds and raisins and pine nuts and 7 or 8 sweet apples. And all of that was pounded together and moistened with fish broth. And then to it was added sugar, 1 ounce of cinnamon, pepper, 4 ounces of jujubes, that's a little date-like fruit, not the candy. And the whole mixture is poured into a pie dough, and 3 or 4 skinned pre-boiled eels are added. And then it's sealed with another sheet of pastry and sprinkled with sugar on top. And no, there's nothing really unusual about cooking fish and fruits together with nuts and sugar. And in fact, it's not for another whole century that we find sweet and savory flavors separated, you know, in different courses. And in fact, in Italy, that flavor combination lasts through the whole entire early modern period. But in sum, the dominant style of the early 16th century in Italy, both in the arts and in the cuisine, favored this elaborate, sophisticated presentation, offering as many different ingredients as possible, cooked in as many ways as possible. And in Mrs. Bugo and in other cookbooks, many foods received increased emphasis as well. And I should say, really, its dairy products and cheeses begin to get much greater coverage than in any medieval cookbook, as do fish prepared dozens of different ways with very innovative sauces. We still find organ meats, liver, testicles, various salty cured pork products appear with greater frequency than before. And again, I think, though the 16th century Italian cooking inherited a lot of features from the Middle Ages, the wealth, the variety, and the copiousness of the presentation make it something quite new. So next time, on the threshold of modernity, let's see what's happening on the other side of the world, in the Aztec Empire, exactly at the same time as these banquets in Ferrara.
Thanks for listening to episode 15 of Food, A Cultural Culinary History. Just a reminder, if you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts, featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from inventions, physiology and fitness, outdoor cooking, the science of color, great orchestral works, behavioral economics, you name it. At The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.